if you have even a little bit of imagination, that second chapter presents quite a sight, doesn't it? The armies of Israel, the armies of the Lord, all set out with their banners, the families, their generations, the fathers, the sons, all in their place, all in their order, ready to follow the Lord. It's quite an impressive sight, isn't it? Can you picture it? You know, 600,000 fighting men setting off on their way. This is the second of the messages that I'm bringing to you from the book of Numbers. I'm not preaching chapter 1 like last time. I didn't preach chapter 1. I'm not preaching chapter 2 tonight. But we're just doing some readings. But I'm preaching broadly themes that you find in this book, the book of Numbers. And the theme tonight is the Lord of the generations. Lord of the generations. This book that we're reading here spans a period of 40 years. 40 years from the first events at the beginning of the book to the last events at the end of the book is a 40-year period. In fact, the first 10 chapters is just 20 days while they're encamped, receiving instructions, getting themselves in place, getting themselves in order. The next, say from chapter 10 to 24, 15 chapters of the book are the journeys as they head out into the wilderness, 38 years. In fact, some dedicated scholar worked out 38 years, 3 months, 10 days. The detail, the data is in there. You can actually chart it out like that. And then the last section of the book, chapter 25 to 36, the last 10 chapters of the book is a further 5-month period when they've arrived in the plains of Moab. So essentially 40 years of history. 40 years. What happened to that army? That great, glorious army setting out on its campaign. What's going to happen to them? What's going to become of them? What victories? What defeats? What's before them all? As the people of God go forward, what will befall the people of God? What will happen in the course of this generation? Because 40 years has a lot of significance as a phrase. You find it in the Bible used again and again. 40 years represents a generation. What's going to happen in this generation? And a generation, it reflects a period of time when, I don't want to be too sort of silly about it, but you can kind of go from nappies to pappies. I couldn't think of a better way of putting it like that. You could start out as a little baby, grow up, become a man, start a family, see them start to grow up and become men. I'm talking about the fathers and the sons. I was thinking of the army in particular. And you can, in 40 years, arrive at a point where your children's children, you can see your children's children born. So in a 20-year period, it's expected a person can come to maturity, bear children. They can grow in a 20-year period, come to children. In other words, you can go from being in nappies to being a grandpappy in the period of 40 years. That's a generation. You can become a grandparent in 40 years. I don't know what you think the average first-time grandparents, what the average age for first-time grandparents is in the world today. I don't know what you think it would be. 35, in the global average, 35. What do you think? More or less? As an average. It's 49. It's 49. It's a bit higher, but it's still low, isn't it? 49. You know, we don't think of ourselves as necessarily becoming grandparents at 49 years old, but that's the global average, and that is a consequence of incredible steps forward in health, family care, and so on and so forth that put that average up. 40 is a generation. That's when kind of people became grandparents in the ancient world. And when you look at the beginning of the book that we've kind of got open in front of us at the moment, we're seeing a snapshot of that first part of the generation, the leaders of the generation, the grandparents of that day, the parents of that day, the sons of that day. And the records, as you see there in chapter 1, verse 3, says that as they began to take an account of everybody, they're only taking reference of everybody who is 20 years old and upwards. There was no upper limit for military service. This doesn't say 20 to 50. You don't have to retire at 50. You start at 20. At 20, you're expected to take up arms and fight. And then from that point upwards, you will find your place within armed service in one way, shape, or form. And the older men, the men of experience, they are expected to be the commanders in chief, the leaders, the supervisors, the people with experience who can guide and govern. And then the next generation down, they're your staff sergeants and your captains and your lieutenants as it goes down. And the young ones, they're the grunts. They're going to carry the spears and they're going to be your infantry and so on and so forth. That's the kind of basic formation that everybody's going to find their place from 20-year-olds and plus. But what's amazing that every single person mentioned here, all the people whose names we've just heard in the readings, both last week and this week, every single one of them was born a slave. None of them have been in the army. None of them have had that kind of experience before. They've all been born. The expectations they were raised with was they were going to spend their life doing servile work, not fighting for their freedom or to maintain their freedom, to be servile, to serve the Egyptians and to do their bidding. They may have had hopes and prayer. We know they had aspirations and prayers that God would save them from that condition of life, and God in his power did it. But that's how they were born. They were born as slaves, every single one of these people whose names, that whole army, that great army you've just seen, people born in slavery. And they've spent the whole of their lives, whether they're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, even the 80-year-olds amongst them, every single one of them, some of them have known 50, 60 years of slavery, more. That's all their life experience. But they're in the army now. And everything's changing, isn't it? Everything's changing for them. Now, as this book unfolds, this 40-year period, if we were going to the end of the book, the same generation that we're following, the 20-year-olds, they're now 60-year-olds, aren't they? The youngsters here, the infantrymen, the grunts here, they're now the majors and the more senior military commanders, aren't they? That would be the natural progression of things. It's the young ones coming up. They've gained experience and they're moving up the ranks. And the ones that were the leaders, the old men that who led the congregation and the army in that time, many of them will have, you know, naturally perhaps they would have died. And they've been filling up the places and taking up the places. That's what happens in battles, isn't it? They used to put the men out front and one line would fall and then the next would come and take their place and they'd fall and you keep advancing and you keep advancing until you've won your victory and you've got your piece of ground. Now, the difference is that when these men here that we're reading out about at the beginning of the book, every single one of them, all they'd known all their life was slavery. But as we get to the end of the book, the same people who are now 60, 70, 80 years old, they've had more than half of their life, most of them, now as free. You know, you've had an experience where your life has been changed. You maybe was born as a slave, but you've now spent more of your life as a free man than you ever spent as a slave. Their life has changed. And more than that, the children that they've had born to them, they've never known what it is to be slaves. They were born free. And so you have this new generation growing up who have not known what it is to be born a slave. They're a free-born generation. Slavery may have been the formative experience of that first generation, but time has gone by and that is not what is dictating anymore. Freedom is their life experience. All of them, they're learning about freedom. And the children, they're learning about it from the beginning. From the beginning, the responsibilities of freedom. In chapter 26 and verse 2, if you wanted to turn there, you'll see that the 40-year period goes by. And a time comes when the Lord commands that a second census be taken. The first one is at the beginning there, chapter 1, verse 3. You see the census of the army. You see the names. You see their numbers. It's all recorded. And then 40 years later, God says, a second census. 40 years have passed. And in that second census, All the people there being listed in chapter 26, verse 2 onwards in the second census, all the people have been listed there who are now enrolled into the army, the 20-year-olds, the 30-year-olds, the 40-year-olds, none of them have ever known slavery. None of them. You have a new generation growing up. And they are different. These two generations are different generations with different life experiences. One of them, for them, slavery was their past, their history, where they were. And some of them, they have no idea what that means apart from what they've heard others talking about. It's not their experience. They were born free. They were born in the wilderness. They were born raised up in that situation. And so you've got two generations who are now being melded into one army, and they have their life expectancies, experiences are very, very different. So the 60, 70, 80-year-olds in the second census, the top brass, presumably, of the army, theoretically, that's where their position should be by now. Leaders. And the 20 to 59-year-olds, the lower ranks, all born in the wilderness, they are the supporting positions, and then the infantry, and so on and so forth. So I just want to flag this up at the beginning, that this book, as it moves ahead, makes us think about how generations work together, how we relate to each other, how we get on, the influence that generations have on one another. Have you noticed that in our, one of the things people teach now at theological college, when you go to theological college, you can go and study missiology, the study of mission. And one of the things they often try to impact, and that's what we were looking at when we were in 1 Corinthians, was in the importance of cross-cultural mission, realizing that other people are different to you, and you can't just go in there and expect them all to be like you are. Otherwise, it'll all come and start. You've got to, find out who they are and come alongside them with your message of the gospel. But one of the number one crises, especially in the British church at this time, and it's happening in other parts of the world, is that the generations that are growing up side by side in the church at this time, the older generation and the younger generation, their life experiences are so different that in some sense it's almost like cross-cultural mission. That the terms of reference from one generation to another are so different. It's at times where we don't necessarily even speak the same language or understand things in the same way. That basic assumptions that some people take in one generation are a mystery, an entire mystery to another generation. It's something they've heard about and they've been told, but it's not their life. And these two generations growing up, they have such different lives. And yet they are one in the same army, fighting side by side, and they're having to work out their relationship in Christ, if I can put it like that. So I think it's quite an interesting book. It's an interesting book for that reason. That sounds rather pompous for me to declare it's an interesting book. It's the Word of God, and I'm privileged to have this book open before us tonight. So let's notice a few things about how these two generations are getting along. What does the book of Numbers tell us about how they rub along, how they serve one another, how they work together, how it prospers? Numbers chapter 26, verse 51, should be around where you are at the moment, tells us the sum total of the size of Israel's army, 40 years. You saw that glorious army at the beginning. Let's now see how many soldiers are in the field there in chapter 26, 51. 601,730, yes? You see it? 601,730. And without looking, some observant person will tell me how many soldiers there were in Numbers chapter 1, verse 46, when they first set off. How much? 18, huh? An 1,800 difference, plus or minus? Minus, oh, you are wrong. We salute you, sir. No, Ron, I said, I salute you, I salute you. Quick mathematics, quick mathematics. There are 603,550 at the beginning of the 40 years. There's 601,730 at the end of the 40 years. There is a minus 0.3% decline in numbers in the armed services after that 40-year period. I mean, for argument's sake, it's stayed static, hasn't it? It hasn't grown. As a congregation, as a gathering, as a force, it has not increased. Okay? Over a 40-year period. Now, what do we make of this? Let's remember where these people are. They are in one of the most inhospitable places in the world. They are in the desert, in the wilderness, hardly any water, hardly any food, hostile tribes. The fact that they've gone in and come out is a miracle, isn't it? Because humanly speaking, as we were saying last time, at the beginning, when they all set off, bold as brass, and they've got their banners, but they're going out not to fight against another great army. They're going out to fight the forces, the ferocious forces of nature, aren't they? And you can have your shield and your sword, but in the end, 50 degrees of heat, day in, day out, and hardly any water, and scrubland, that's going to wear down whoever you are, wherever you are. I'm telling you, to see these people come out, it's like seeing the children, you know, like the Hebrew children were thrown into the fire in the story of Daniel. And they were thrown in the fire and they came back out hardly smelling a smoke. It's like a miracle. It's like to see Jesus going into the grave and then coming back out again. It's a miracle. The fact that they came out again is a miracle. The whole desert should be full of their dead bodies. But they're alive. They're alive. So the book of Numbers has got lots to be excited about. You know, God has done a wonderful thing in the desert. Okay, good, good. But, they haven't grown. So, you'd think that if God was able to keep them, you'd think God would be able to prosper them, wouldn't you? If he's able to keep them in the wilderness, why apparently didn't he bless and increase them in the wilderness? Is anything too difficult for God? And yet we see this static figure coming out of the desert. Now, do you know the world population, in the last 40 years, do you know how much the world's population has grown by as a percentage? In 40 years, the world's population has grown 40%. It is an unprecedented period. It's really since modern medicines and all the rest of it, hasn't it? We have added in the last 40 years 2 billion people to the population of the planet. From 5 billion to 7 billion people. 40%. That is astronomic growth, isn't it? The explosion in modern healthcare and so on and so forth, right? But if you go back before 1900, when all these remarkable things started to happen, and you looked at population growth going back, the basic normal year on, year in, was plus 0.3% growth going back over the centuries. So over 40 years, the quick mathematicians amongst you, we are doing numbers, so there's bound to be some maths, isn't there, right? You there? 0.3% over 40 years? Hmm? She's good. She's good. Give her a banana. Very good. 12%. So you take 600,000 or thereabouts and you add 12%, you've got 70,000 people who you would expect to see in those forces that aren't there. 70,000 people! Under normal conditions, you would like to think that this group would be multiplying and increasing at that rate over that 40-year period, and you'd see them advance by a figure of approximately 70,000 people. You'd like to see the army going from 600,000 to 670,000 people, and it hasn't happened. Where is the growth? And you can say to yourself, well, are you mad, Ben Midgley? It's the desert. It's a miracle that they've come out at all. But yes, it is a miracle. And who did it? It's God. So why is God able to protect them, but he hasn't prospered them? I still find myself asking that question. 70,000 people is a lot of people to lose if that's the condition, right? As you go through the book of Numbers, we actually find quite a lot of information about what happened to the people on the journeys. And you know what? You'd think that if there were an excessive number of people dying during the wilderness years, that's 70,000, what would be the number one cause? You'd imagine malnutrition, or thirst, dying of thirst, or sunstroke, or something like that. But it wasn't. It wasn't. All those years, the thing that bit into their numbers time and time and time and time again was plague. They were plagued. Now, if I say the word plague, I hope theologically that should make you think of something. What's that? Egypt. What happened in Egypt? Yes? Plague. God plagued Egypt, didn't he? And here, now, Egypt's long begone, been plagued and decimated. And what's been happening to Israel, the beloved of the Lord, who's been set free, what happened to them in the wilderness? They were plagued. Plague after plague after plague. But I thought we were the people of God. That's what happens to the Egyptians. But they experienced plague after plague. If chapter 11, verse 34, for example. Chapter 11, verse 34. We see the record of what is described there as a very great plague broke out. And then we see the phrase that a number were buried. So we don't know how many people died. But people died. And the word very great is not something the Bible throws around lightly. We imagine that a considerable number of people died. Chapter 16, verse 49. I'm skipping over one or two small examples. I'm focusing on the larger examples. The second great plague, chapter 16, verse 49, we read, and there, what's different there is we start to get some figures now. It is the book of Numbers, after all. 14,700 people. 14,700 people died of plague. That's a massive blow, isn't it? Staggering figures. Chapter 21, verse 6. I don't know the circumstances of what happened, but it says that there were all these snakes and serpents and people were bitten by venomous creatures out in the wilderness. And it says, many died, many died. You remember there was plagues, wild animals were sent against the Egyptians. And, you know, again, it seems like all these snakes were just, they're being plagued out in the wilderness. And then chapter 25, verse 9, just before the census is taken, a plague, the greatest of the plagues that are mentioned in this book. 24,000 people lose their lives. Now, if you add all those figures up, because we're in the book of Numbers, you'll realize we've got about 40,000 people there. And if we take the very great and the two figures that don't give us the actual numbers of deaths, and we could give a bit of brevity and width to it, and realize that there are other recording of plagues in this book as well that haven't got enumeration, I don't think a missing 60 or 70,000 people is strange maths at all. So they should have grown. They could have grown, except these plagues kept setting them back. They didn't make the normal growth that you'd have expected to see from the people of God, because they were plagued. And here's the shocker. Chapter 11, verse 33. Here's the shocker. God sent the plagues. Just like God sent the plagues against Egypt, He is now plaguing His people, Israel. And it happens again and again. Chapter 21, verse 6, you don't have to turn there. The Lord sent the snakes. He did it. Why didn't they? Now, the word church, you know, it's a very artificial expression. It came from 16th century ecclesiology. The word there that's translated from the Greek, ecclesia, is a congregation or a gathering. Why was this ecclesia, this gathering, this congregation, this church, why wasn't it growing? Because God kept plaguing it. And so it couldn't grow as you think it might. So you could say, oh, well, the Lord did it. The Lord didn't want it to grow. The Lord likes it like this. But that's not the answer, is it? That isn't the answer. Why did the Lord plague His church? And we see again and again in this book, chapter 11, verse 1, going back to that first example, that first plague that we mentioned. Why did the Lord plague them? Because the people complained. They aroused His anger. Chapter 11, verse 5. This is interesting. Say, we remember the fish that we used to eat back in Egypt. Hearkening back, that's their complaint. It was better back then, in the old days. I know we were slaves, but oh, the food was great. Better than this. Better than this. So tell me which generation are complaining here. Is it the new generation? The young generation who've been born out in the wilderness, who've never eaten a fish in their life. They've never even seen a fish. Born in the desert. Are they the names mentioned at the beginning of the book? Or the main names mentioned at the end of the book? Who was it that complained? The first or the last generation? It was the first, wasn't it? Yes? The first. Chapter 16, this is the second example of the plague. 16 verse 2, we read that prior to the great plague that broke out, 250 leaders rose up against Moses. 250 of them. Now that's quite a considerable thing to experience, isn't it? 250 leaders coming at you. But so they did. Tell me, from which generation did the leaders come? Wasn't it? And then the plague broke out. In chapter 26 and verse 1. Sorry, before that, chapter 25 verse 1, 5, 21 verse 5. Before all the snakes were sent out against them, they cry, the people cry, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die? Who came out of Egypt? Which generation was it that came out of Egypt? Yes? Who makes comparisons between how things are now and how things used to be? The people who've got the long memories are going to remember. Again and again and again, this generation. And so, now, maybe to let that generation off the hook, you could say a little bit, chapter 26, verse 1, the greatest of all the plagues broke out after the people began to commit harlotry. And he doesn't say who those people were, what age they were, what generation. But you have to ask the question, who taught this group to disobey the Lord? From whom did they get an example of grumbling and complaining and seeking their own way? And that's when 24,000 of them fell, and we were reading that. And bear in mind that in chapter 14, verse 21, you don't have to turn there unless you want to, chapter 14, verse 21 to 23, I'll read it to you. Chapter 14, verse 23, which is only halfway through the book, mind. Only halfway through the book. By chapter 14, verse 23, God says, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to the forefathers. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. That generation has had enough. It's had enough. If you go forward to chapter 32, again, that terrible, terrible sentence is repeated a second time. Chapter 32 and verse 11. It says there, because they have not followed me wholeheartedly, not one of the men, 20-year-old and more, who came up out of Egypt, that's that first list, will see the land I promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Not one is reiterated there. That generation, through their grumbling and their complaining and the poor example they set, was struck out and disqualified from obtaining the prize, the land. I do have some good news, mind. And it's this. Chapter 32, verse 12. There's one beautiful, beautiful, beautiful little word here. Except. Not one except. And it says there in verse 12. So we said, not one except Caleb, verse 12, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have followed the Lord wholeheartedly. Aren't you glad there are exceptions? Aren't you glad God makes exceptions and shows mercy and is kind and keeps for himself a people who will serve the Lord? Exceptional men of exceptional faith and determination and strength of heart and commitment to Christ. They carried on leading, didn't they? Everybody else got disqualified. We read in 1 Corinthians this morning. Remember the passage? It was referring to these events, wasn't it, in 1 Corinthians as we read it this morning. Nice the way these things work out. We read all about it. Everybody else got disqualified. Their bodies strewn over the wilderness. None of them made it except. So I would say this is my second point. Numbers, so we've said that how important it is these generations work together. And it says how important, how precious it is to have godly leadership from the older generation. Okay, maybe this is stated by a negative example because of how many of them fell. But it just goes to show how important that ministry is, the ministry of older people in the church who've got experience and have been tempted and are tried and have overcome again and again consistently through the wilderness. People like Caleb, people like Joshua, to be the people, an exceptional people, to have exceptional older people who can teach the generations that are coming up behind the value of holding fast to the promises of God and not letting go despite the hardships that you face and pressing on until you get the prize. I thank God for older people who serve God. They are precious, and God particularly singles such people out here in the book of Numbers. I think this is one of the things that the book teaches. As time goes by, it's tough. Time is a hard environment, isn't it? The world's a hard place, and as time goes by, people suffer many things. It's difficult. Life is difficult. But to overcome and come through and to run your race and see it to the end, that's a wonderful thing to witness. And to know people who are continuing to serve God right through into their 60s, their 70s, their 80s, into their 90s, that's a glory to God, isn't it? And speaking for the younger generation, if I even can sort of stand somewhere in the middle somewhere. So I'm out of it. I'm excused. It is so encouraging. There's nothing more disheartening. It's thinking back of my own time, growing up, coming as a Christian in my 20s. When you can't find an older, godly man who can be as a father to you in the house of God, who can speak with experience. I'm talking mostly about men because this passage is mostly about the army and so on and so forth. You can transpose this across into women because it's applicable, isn't it? But the preciousness and the value of people who've been serving the Lord for not 5 years or 3 years like most of your friends, but 30 years or 40 years and are still shining for Jesus. Okay? So I think this is something really precious here in the book. So, third and final point. What this book tells us in the end, in chapter 26, when the census is taken, the second census is taken, that the leaders of the tribes, the leaders in the army, the people who are at the front, the people who are leading, you would reasonably have expected from the beginning of the book that those same people would have persevered and stick at it. They may be old, and the world may not think something of it, but they know their God and their people of experience, and they're there benefiting and blessing the congregation with their lives. But in truth, we find there's only two of them left. And who's leading the church? Who's leading the church? The young generation. But that is not the ideal. That may be the reality of the situation, but it's not the ideal. Because you take a young person and you expose them to too much when they haven't been tried and tested. It's tough. It's tough. But here, that's the situation. When you get to chapter 26, the people who are leading the church, they're a younger generation. You would expect them to still be learning and being discipled and taught and brought on and given new experiences. But they've been pushed to the forefront. And they are now going to have to stand. There's a sadness across this book because the truth is God is so good, isn't he? God was able to keep them through the wilderness, and God was able to prosper them in the wilderness. But instead of prospering in the wilderness, they survived. They survived. They kept the doors open instead of prospering. And a new generation, the way had to be cleared for a new generation to come through and to lead the church. Because the truth is, all the grumbling and all the complaining had seriously damaged their progress to the tune of 70,000 souls that could or should have filled their ranks and encouraged their hearts. But instead, you could look back over the tracks of the wilderness and see their bodies food for the birds. And that is a tragedy. Even the most promising people amongst them, there's Miriam, wasn't there? Miriam! She saw Moses there, exposed to the bulrushes, protected him, steered him to a safe harbor, found her mother, his mother, to come and suckle him. When Moses appeared, she played the tambourine and led the people in praise. She's described as a prophet. But let me tell you, in chapter 20, verse 1 of the book of Numbers, we read, she died out in the wilderness. She grumbled, she complained, she rebelled. What did we read this morning? If you consider that you are standing, be careful, lest you... Miriam, Aaron, the older brother of Moses, who translated for him, stood before Pharaoh, let my people go. Saw the plague, saw the miracles, walked through the Red Sea, was anointed with a crown, holy unto the Lord, the high priestly garments, all those blessings, offerings, sacrifices, and praises to God. But we read, chapter 20, verse 29, he died in the wilderness. He never saw the land. Why? He rebelled. He rebelled against the Lord. No one except Joshua and Caleb. People you wouldn't necessarily have thought, oh, that'll be the one. But they just were concentrated on God. So when the census is taken in, coming through to the end here, chapter 26, verse 1, the person who's actually taking up the census is a young man called Eleazar, the son of Aaron. This should have been Aaron's great crowning glory, but he's not there. This young man, Eleazar, is taking over. And yes, Moses is there, and thank God for a man like Moses speaking the word of God in their midst, year in, year out, bringing faithfully the word of God in their midst. And thank God for Caleb saying, amen, year in, year out, standing by his side. And for Joshua standing there going, we're going to go forward, year in, year out. And there's the hope, of course, when these next generation come into the land, then they will begin to grow and multiply and prosper and so on and so forth. But those 40 years, the reason they spent 40 years in the wilderness, we discover in chapter 32, verse 13, is that God made them wander in the wilderness until that generation, the rest of them, were gone. Now, I think final thing needs saying is this. When we read 1 Corinthians chapter 10 this morning, and I just want to refer that to you once again, we read this about this generation. It says, chapter 10, verse 1, I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud, that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses and in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them. That rock was Christ. These people knew the Lord, didn't they? The people who fell knew the Lord. They knew the Lord. And yet they still fell. Now, and I've asked myself this question, and perhaps you ask yourself the question. The fact that they didn't obtain the land, is that a bit like saying people who fall then don't obtain heaven? Do you see what I'm driving at? Is that a direct relation? The fact that they didn't receive the land, is that saying that people who fall will not receive heaven? And I'm not sure it does. But I don't want to be so categorical about that as to engender in anybody a false sense of comfort that make them think that if I can carry on like that and it'll be all right, because I'm not absolutely 100% certain. But I'm pretty sure that even those who fell in the wilderness, though they might not see the land, may yet see heaven. Okay? I'm pretty sure. And I wouldn't want anybody to step out on that plank just in case I'm wrong. Okay? Because heaven is that precious. But I'm pretty sure. See, I think, like the Corinthians and us at times, we make bad decisions. And we are who we are. And we're human. And the next generation that follows after us, guess what? Wherever they're born, and however different they are from us, they will make bad decisions. and there will be consequences for them. And the truth is, as we're told, even by the prophet Isaiah, we all sin and we all fall short of the glory of God. Everyone, without exception. There is no except in this case, but Christ. They may have fallen in the wilderness. They may not have seen the land, but they still died free. They weren't in Egypt anymore. They'd crossed over from that. I think they lost their rewards. What a reward it would have been. I said it to you last time. What a joy it must have been to just look out and see the River Jordan in front of you and realizing, there it is. There it is. Everything we've heard about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, there's our land. They didn't get that. They didn't experience that. They fell. But I don't know if that means that they lost their salvation, because they did escape Egypt. They did say goodbye to all that. But this I know. I'm not being categorical about that. But this I know. Numbers teaches us that a choice exists for us. We have choices. And if we make bad decisions, there will be bad consequences. There will be consequences. We can't avoid the consequences. And that if we rebel and we grumble, whichever generation we come from, if we think it won't have any consequences, if you won't hold up the growth and the prosperity and the blessing we seek, it will. It will. It happened to them, and it's happened down through the generation. It will happen to us. So, ultimately, the final lesson must be, like Caleb, like Joshua, like the others, the only safe road is to serve the Lord wholeheartedly, isn't it? From generation to generation, passing that baton on, serve the Lord wholeheartedly, and then you don't have to worry about the exceptions, because you become the rule. I'm going to leave it there. I really do hope that you will spend some time reading this book, this wonderful book of Numbers, in your own private time. I know you all have your own reading plans and you spend your time reading the Bible and the things that you particularly are following up, but I hope you will find time to enrich yourself.